Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama is in New York City to wag a finger at Wall Street. But do the details of financial reform legislation really look like they'll make serious change in an industry where Goldman Sachs, for example, can rack up earnings double those of last year's first quarter while facing charges of fraud from the SEC? We'll talk about the state of play with Andrew Coburn, co-producer with Leslie Coburn of last year's feature documentary, American Casino. Also on the show today, it's Earth Day season, which in much of the media means feel-good corporate messaging about how everyone can take simple steps to save the planet. Drive the right kind of car, change a light bulb, buy offsets for your carbon footprint. But does that message actually do harm, drawing attention away from the actual steps necessary to make meaningful changes? Author Heather Rogers delves into these questions in her new book, Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. She'll join us to talk about what she found. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Last year, the PBS show Frontline aired a report called Sick in America. The program excluded any mention of universal public programs in other countries, which led the correspondent T.R. Reid to withdraw from the show. Silencing supporters of single-payer or Medicare for All, then, is a media staple. But Frontline found a new way to do that on their April 13th special, Obama's Deal. This is all the more striking because the show actually interviewed a single-payer advocate and showed footage of pro-single-payer protests. Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program was interviewed in the show, but her position on health care is never explained. In fact, the way Frontline used her quotes and the footage of the protests she was a part of made it seem like these were protests to support the public option, which is not at all the same thing as single-payer and was actually an idea many single-payer advocates opposed. In the report, Frontline explained that the insurance industry helped kill the public option as a bill was being debated in the Senate Finance Committee. They cut to footage of protests by Flowers and others at a Senate hearing. A voice is then heard saying, quote, "This option cannot be part of the discussion at a Senate hearing? Now I think that's wrong," close quote. The implication, then, is that these were pro-public option protesters, or as Frontline put it, quote, "the left counterattacked," close quote. It's never explained that they were actually protesting the exclusion of a single-payer advocate from the hearing, and that the voice that was heard was actually MSNBC host Ed Schultz, a single-payer supporter. So far, Frontline's response to all this has been to say that, well, single-payer wasn't really part of the discussion in Washington anyway, which is true, no thanks to a media system that made sure to exclude it from their coverage.
Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz noted all the corporate media attention to the so-called Tea Party around Tax Day, April 15th. But Kurtz's Next Day web column still got things wrong by saying the press corps' current focus came, quote, "after initially dismissing the tea types as an unimportant sideshow," close quote. Anyone with a television knows that supposed time period never existed. Elite media have been interested in the Tea Partiers, their thoughts, their beliefs, their desires, since the beginning, in a way that few other citizen protest movements have had the fortune to experience. Indeed, the same day as Kurtz's column, his own paper ran a story that ought to meet anyone's standards for positive treatment. Describing the previous day's rallies, Post writers Amy Gardner and Michael Ruane wrote, quote, "The showing, while smaller than the crowds that gathered in Washington on September 12th, made clear that the ire and energy that have defined the Tea Party movement since it became a force last summer have not abated," close quote. Funny, you would think that smaller crowds would be a sign that the ire and energy of the Tea Party movement have abated. That's kind of what abated means. Whatever you call this kind of reporting, dismissive, it isn't.
The April 26th cover of Newsweek is a doozy. The headline reads, "Don't Mess with Texas: What Governor Rick Perry's Hard Right Creed Tells Us About America." Inside, you won't learn much about America, but you will learn that Newsweek really likes Rick Perry. How much? Well, how's this for a description? Quote, "ruggedly handsome, in a Marlboro man sort of way, with a rich mane of brown hair, slightly tinged with silver gray. Perry, 60, stands for less government and more growth, for freedom and against bureaucracy, for Texas and against Washington. It's a message that has made him a very popular politician in Texas, particularly among conservative white males. Close quote. Newsweek goes on to wonder if Perry might be the second coming of Ronald Reagan. The fact that there's even an election seems a formality. Who would be foolish enough to run against this handsome savior? Enter Perry's Democratic opponent, Houston Mayor Bill White, who Newsweek tells us, quote, couldn't be more different from Perry. He went to Harvard. He speaks fluent Spanish. He's pasty white with a bald pate and big ears. He talks in an even, slow monotone and refrains from gunslinging rhetoric. He's kind of like President Obama, without the good looks and charisma, close quote. The piece also tells us that the Texas economy is booming, though near the end we read that the state expects a $15 billion budget shortfall this year. And despite the fact that Perry thinks Obama is a socialist, he took $16 billion in stimulus money. Another thing you wouldn't know from reading Newsweek's puff piece, Perry and his pasty, uncharismatic Democratic challenger are in a pretty tight race. Perry only holds a 4-point lead right now. Newsweek doesn't have time to mess with such nuance.
Well, sometimes reports in the U.S. press select their sources or frame their analysis in such a way as to subtly suggest a particular political point of view to the reader. But I guess there's not always time for that. In those cases, you wind up with lines like this clunker from an April 20th Reuters piece. Quote, Israel, like the United States, European Union, and others, suspects Iran is developing atomic weapons, a charge Tehran denies. Iran, whose president has said Israel should be wiped off the map, says its nuclear program is peaceful. Close quote. Come on, Reuters, tell us what you really think. Or rather, what you'd really like us to think.
And finally, Rush Limbaugh was wrong about something. I know, we'll give you a moment to recover from the shock. The circumstances here, though, are downright disgusting. On his April 13th show, Limbaugh fingered the culprit in the deaths of 29 workers at the Upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. It was the miners' union. Quote, the union is generally holding these companies up, demanding all kinds of safety. Why were these miners continuing to work in what apparently was an unsafe atmosphere? Close quote. Well, as most people know, the Massey Mining Company is notoriously anti-union, and the Upper Big Branch facility was non-union. When told about this error, Limbaugh doubled down, declaring on his April 15th show that, in fact, 85 union coal miners won a decision against Massey, and they were rehired. Thus, there were union workers there. That wouldn't even save Limbaugh's original claim, but that's not how he saw it as he gloated over his triumph.
There were union workers at that mine, and the left is trying to say, you can't say that, Limbaugh, why there's a non-union shop. That SOB CEO got rid of all the... No, no, he agreed to bring back 85 of them. So, you know, you people, it's been 21 years. At some point, you are going to learn. If you go up against me on a challenge of fact, you are going to be wrong. Just that simple.
You know what's even simpler? Fact-checking. The workers Limbaugh is talking about worked at a different Massey mine, as the United Mine Workers explained in their response to Limbaugh. And the company is appealing the ruling, which means they're not even back on the job yet. No word yet from Limbaugh on how this still proves that he's right.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. I'll give information about Extra later on in the show. As we record this program, Barack Obama is here in New York City, scheduled, we're told, to deliver a rhetorical scolding to Wall Street and call for tighter regulation of the financial industry. Rupert Murdoch's tabloid New York Post has a cover that implores, please, Mr. President, don't kill the golden goose. The implication that the financial reform legislation currently proposed would impose such dramatic changes on the industry that it might actually imperil the city's economic future. future. But does a careful look at the legislation, combined with awareness of the political process, suggest a foundation for that sort of concern? Joining us now to talk about the possibilities for financial reform is Andrew Coburn, co-producer with Leslie Coburn of American Casino, the 2009 feature documentary on the financial catastrophe. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Andrew Coburn.
Hey, nice to be with you.
Obama's visit, of course, comes against the backdrop of the SEC charges of fraud against Goldman Sachs for creating and selling a kind of mortgage-backed security that was, unknown to investors, of course, designed to fail and then betting against it, collecting money on all sides of the deal, if you will. That case is seen by some as a signal that the White House really plans to get tough on Wall Street excesses. So let's get right to what seems to be the key question we need the press to answer. Does the legislation now being considered get at the sorts of murky activities that the Goldman case shines a pin light on and that are seen as the problem?
When things melted down in the fall of 2008, the banks, who are no fools, could see that, you know, that this they were going to be faced, along with the other problems they had, but they were going to be faced with calls for regulation and tightening up and all the sort of things they've gotten away with in the last 20 years in terms of deregulation. There was going to be a big popular mood to reverse that. So they beefed up their lobbying firepower in Washington. They hired a very smart guy called Ed Rosen of the firm of Cleary Gottlieb, who put together a plan. He actually wrote a memo about what should happen, you know, that there should be regulation that should stay with the Federal Reserve. I mean, it was a whole sort of guideline to, if anyone wanted to reform financial regulation, this is what they should do. And surprise, 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 that's more or less exactly what the administration under Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner came up with. Then we started to get legislation in Congress, first of all from the House Financial Services Committee, for Barney Frank, and amazingly enough, the bill that came out of there was more or less what the banks and Mr. Rosen had said, you know, that they could sort of live with. So everything's been going more or less okay for them, including with the Dodd bill in the Senate, nothing that worried them too much, until last week, when suddenly Blanche Lincoln, chairperson of the House, Senate Agriculture Committee, and I should say the Agriculture Committees have jurisdiction over derivatives, because originally derivatives were meant to be about farmers hedging the price of grain and other commodities. She, because she's in severe re-election trouble back down in Arkansas, and also because she wanted to make a point with Timothy Geithner, so I'm told, she put in a killer provision that said that the big banks had to dump their derivatives trading desks. Now, this is their nightmare. This is where they make their money.
And, of course, is seen for many people as the site of many of the conflicts of interest.
Sure. I mean, derivatives trading is what brought us the catastrophe. But the banks don't care about that. They want to keep things as they are. But if this stays in the legislation, and I'm kind of dubious about that it will, I mean, just because the stakes are so high, then we've finally, you know, we the people finally have a shot.
Well, you're talking about really one paragraph inserted in this, you know, thousands of pages of legislation, and that's just the kind of thing we need reporters to really dig out. I wonder what you make in general of the way the U.S. media have approached coverage of the financial crisis. I was struck by the lead on a New York Times online story on April 20th, which was, quote, beset by accusations of securities fraud, Goldman Sachs nevertheless showed Tuesday that it was still very good at what it does best, making money, close quote. By the time the story went to print, they'd changed that opening to suggest that actually the fraud charges were overshadowing earnings reports nearly twice as high as the first quarter of 2009. But that original lead seems to reflect corporate media's stance towards financial industry titans. It's a kind of awed admiration at the way they make bank.
Like, there's quite an interesting book called Too Big to Fail by Sorkin of the New York Times, which I'm not saying it's a bad book. It's actually a very interesting and informative book. But you can't see anything in that book that, you know, it's the way those guys see it, you know, the financial titans. And that's the way the papers generally report it. I mean, look, we've had in the last, I can't remember, 2-3 weeks, we've had absolute confirmation that the Washington Mutual Bank was a total vehicle of fraud. I mean, it's confirmed with documents, with testimony from the very top all the way down. They knew these loans that they were generating and selling were fraudulent. So that's one huge scandal. We know absolutely confirmed that Lehman Brothers was cooking its books, was breaking the law and, you know, cooking the books with this, you know, with a device called Repo 105, among others. We know, Citigroup passed on $100 billion worth of mortgage loans to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, labeling them as conforming. You know, those in Freddie and Fannie were meant to take only certain kinds of loans, not subprime, no-doc loans, you know, of the kinds that have been so disastrous. Citigroup lied and, you know, labeled them as conforming when they weren't. You know, again, another massive fraud. We've had four instances just in the last few weeks of just what a huge fraudulent exercise the whole thing has been. And yet, the corporate media don't describe it that way. They don't say, you know, we have a crime scene down here, which I think they should.
Finally, having worked on American Casino, I wonder what your reaction is to a recent CNBC segment where a guest was actually excoriated for even referring to the idea of predatory lending. It seems the tide has really turned on that. The show's anchor said, oh, the phrase predatory lending always kills me because how do you force someone to borrow money? Don't borrow it if you can't afford it. And you can imagine what Rick Tea Party Santelli had to say. What can a viewer finally take away from a conversation about the housing crisis that denies the existence of predatory lending?
Well, that's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I was just looking at an article by Paul Krugman in the New York Review of Books where he makes the point, it was something that struck us when we were showing American Casino around the country. There was usually someone who'd stick up their hand and say, but surely it was all caused by people, you know, borrowing money for houses they couldn't afford. It's their fault. I mean, only get one person saying that because in the film, we really address that issue and show what a load of baloney it is. But nonetheless, as Krugman was pointing out, he says that the right wing, despite all evidence to the contrary, it's really taken hold that this whole crisis wasn't caused by, you know, fraud in banks or, you know, excess Chinese bond buying or any of the other reasons you get held about, but it was caused by the banks being forced by liberal politicians to lend money to people who couldn't afford the loans. And that's what the right wing believes. You know, that's the excuse they've given themselves. But that the fact that they're now trying to stamp out use of the phrase predatory lending shows how far things have swung.
Andrew Coburn is co-producer of the documentary feature American Casino. You can find information on the web at AmericanCasinoTheMovie.com. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Well, thank you, Jimmy.
The annual Earth Day celebrations bring familiar media messages. GE-owned NBC turns its on-screen logo green, and environmental messages are worked into some of the network's primetime fare. USA Today announced a contest for readers. Switch to an electronic subscription, and you might win a hybrid car. The message seems to be that simple consumer choices can deliver fundamental environmental change. That seems to be the message of so-called green capitalism. The New York Times Earth Day edition includes a special section titled The Business of Green. But what does this emphasis on consumer-driven environmentalism do to the conversation we should be having? And do some of these efforts have much practical impact anyway? Heather Rogers explores some of these questions in her new book, Green Gone Wrong: How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution. She joins us now on the phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Heather Rogers.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Well, in the beginning of the book, you make the point that climate change really broke through in 2006. How that information is translated into people's lives can be a little vague. You point to this very dramatic CNN report about the loss of ice at the North Pole, and then the next segment is Walmart's efforts to sell more green products in its stores. You have to think the two were placed together not by accident, and that does seem to be the message we hear around this time of year. Yes, there are serious environmental problems, but there are also solutions that involve buying a different kind of product.
It's very frustrating because, as you point to, there is a much larger conversation that we need to be having. And to keep our eye on this very narrow path of solving environmental crisis via consumer-oriented solutions is really a mistake. In my opinion, it also stymies hope. you know, because it promotes what I've found to be inadequate solutions that often have unintended consequences that do more harm than good.
And your book takes you from biofuel facilities across the world, really, to local farmers in New York. And one of the lessons seemed to be that these simple fixes aren't always simple, and it's not always out of malice. You know, Paul Krugman had this long article in the New York Times Magazine about green economics recently, and he discussed how you could institute a carbon tax that would make food shipped from far away more expensive, so then consumers would buy locally grown food because it would be cheaper. But from your reporting on local farming in New York State, though, it doesn't seem like that solution would be that simple at all, unless you're willing to pay a lot more for food.
Right. And a lot of people say the end of cheap food is over, you know, just as they say the end of cheap oil is over. But in order for that to happen, the end of cheap wages has to be over. So it's not something that the consumer can carry the weight of. You know, this is really something that government needs to be proactive on. And instead, what they're proactive on is supporting big oil, supporting big agriculture, industrial agriculture. You know, the vast majority of the farm bill, the most recent one, was $300 billion. The vast majority of that money goes to environmentally destructive farming and farming that adversely affects family farms and local farms. So what I found in the farms that I visited in New York State is that these farmers who are selling their food already at what anyone would consider exorbitant prices, $40 a pound for greens, $14 a dozen for eggs, these guys can barely make ends meet. And it just, you know, it kind of defies logic, but small farms in the United States only make 5% of their income from selling produce. The rest of the money comes from off-farm jobs, from, you know, trust funds, from various other sources.
There is this sense that some of the conversation about this in the media is kind of upmarket. You need to find pricey beef. The cows only eat grass and it's grown locally. Green architecture. You need to redesign your house or your apartment. The conversation is pitched to the super wealthy to the extent that you almost get this feeling that there's a whole layer of this that's really out of reach for most people. Saving the earth is going to be the business of rich people who read the ads in the New York Times Magazine, making personal choices about what's good for them.
There's also this other phrase, vote with your wallet, and only certain people can vote with their wallets. There is a class dynamic to this that also needs to be interrogated. You mentioned earlier about the segment on CNN. The media, in my estimation, is doing a pretty terrible job of capturing that dynamic and the complexity of the situation. You know, it so often just gets distilled down into this choice that, you know, I make, the individual consumer at the grocery store, at the auto dealer, and it's so much greater than that and really so much richer than that.
You wrote a chapter about the automobile industry, which I found one of the most frustrating parts of the book, because you point out that the media coverage of the auto industry is always about hyping some kind of just off the horizon technological breakthrough that will finally, really, this time we mean it, give us the kinds of lower emission cars that are available in other parts of the world. Your point is that they're manufacturing these cars, they just don't sell them here.
Correct. In the UK, Ford sells a 5-passenger car, it's a compact, that gets 88 miles to the gallon. And they do not sell that car in the United States. The technology exists. This is one of the things I found in writing this book, is that we don't lack the technology. You know, we're always told it's on the horizon, we're almost there, right? But it's here. You know, the future is now. But we don't have it. We don't have access to it because we're waiting for manufacturers to figure out how to make it more profitable, how to make it profitable enough. These auto manufacturers want to make small fuel-efficient cars as profitable as SUVs, and that's not going to happen.
In the meantime, the factories are installing solar panels and reclaiming rainwater as they churn out these gas-guzzling trucks.
Exactly.
On the idea of hope, and you mentioned this earlier, and it's hard not to feel like the problems we're talking about are too big to solve, especially if we're spending so much time talking about non-solutions or half-solutions, or we're putting faith in carbon offset markets that sound a lot like speculation on Wall Street. What's the right way, do you think, for people to approach these issues? How are we supposed to feel hopeful that something big can happen?
I understand how easy it can be to feel overwhelmed by all this. We are so often addressed as individuals and as though the choices that we make are the key to solving this, the consumer-oriented choices that we make. The possibilities for doing things differently are there. And if we continue to accept the narrow options that are presented via the marketplace, you know, we're not getting at the fundamental root causes that got us here in the first place, and we're not spreading our attention to the vast range of other options that are out there. And that's what really kills hope, and that's what really kills choice. You know, we're told we have to sacrifice, we'll have to, you know, we won't have as much choice if we consume less, which is really what we need to do. But 90% of all the food in the grocery store has corn in it. That's definitely a diminishing of choice, a diminishing of possibilities, of diversity. And another example is 25% of all the food in the United States gets thrown away. With all of this wasting, clearly we have the room to reduce consumption. But if we don't deal with the root causes, greater efficiencies that we achieve won't be retired. They will be put back into growing the economy. So we need to separate out what does growth deliver and what does development deliver. You know, differentiate between quantity and quality, essentially.
We've been speaking with Heather Rogers. Her new book, Green Gone Wrong, How Our Economy is Undermining the Environmental Revolution, is available now from Simon & Schuster. You can find her online at heatherrogers.info. Heather Rogers, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Peter, my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That number again, 1-800-847-3993. You can also learn about Extra on FAIR's website, which is fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for your free Counterspin bumper sticker. The show's engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.